The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to our Monday afternoon Space Show program, and I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in. So I do want to make a very short announcement. I'm going to abbreviate all the front-end announcements today as if we're only doing a 60-minute program. I'll explain why in a minute, although we're planning to do the full Space Show program. This would also include the sponsor messages, and that is because our guest, Dr. Bell in Hawaii, has been experiencing, as he said, some communications problems. And we're using a borrowed cell phone that seems to be working okay but does degrade a little in audio quality, and I'm not 100% confident how the audio is going to hold up for 90 minutes. We may have to hang up and call him again and do some tricks I know to do to keep the audio quality going. So I'm shortening the front-end announcements and the sponsor messages just as a conservative contingency to make sure we talk to Dr. Bell and get all of what he has to say rather than you guys hearing me say things that you hear me say on every space show, and you probably tune me out anyway. So a couple of quick things that are important. Our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223, and you can email us if you have questions for Dr. Bell at drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Do remember that the telephone is the preferred way of communicating with our guest. We want you to call and talk with Dr. Jeff Bell. So again, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. And those of you that want to use our blog, it's on our website for this particular program. Just open up the upcoming program page for Dr. Jeff Bell, scroll all the way down to the bottom, and you'll see the place to comment. And when you do that, I'll get your message and I can read it on air. So a couple of other things just to point out. There's an upper left menu. So remember, we do have a store there under support if you're interested in logo wear. The Listen Live button is also in the upper left menu, and that tells you how to listen to live shows, archive shows, Alexa shows, podcasting shows. Share all that information, please, with other listeners. And if you have any questions, don't hesitate to email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And visit our website, thespaceshow.com. We do have our brand new website newsletter for the week posted, and you can see all of our programs that are planned. We have a full week planned, so check that out. And all of our programs are archived, so you can either download or listen to them right on our website. And I do want to point your attention over to center right of the homepage for the Support the Space Show. So this is really important because it is your financial support that keeps the spaceship going, the space show going. Maybe we are a spaceship. And we thank you for your support. So remember, if you're a U.S. taxpayer, you get a tax deduction. We are a 501c3 nonprofit with one, O-N-E, giantleapfoundation.org. And if you're a California taxpayer, we're a public benefit corporation in the Golden State, and you get a tax break here as well. And check us out again at onegiantleapfoundation.org. That's our parent nonprofit website. Or email me with your comments and questions, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And we do have a sponsorship, so I'm not going to read the messages today. As I said, I want to make sure that we get all the talking in we need with Dr. Bell. But you do get a banner ad going across the website, and you do normally get your message read on each show. But today, I'm just going to thank everybody for being a sponsor, which would be the spacedevelopment.org group. for space settlement, the Space Foundation with their upcoming space symposium, the Integrated Space Plan, which you can check out at their website, which is thespaceplan.com, Orbital ATK, AIAA, and Celestis, the premier, factually the only memorial spaceflight service that is around. So if you have questions or comments, email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And Dr. Jeff Bell is our guest today. It's always great when he returns to the program. Jeff has a BS, how appropriate, in physics and astronomy from the University of Michigan. And by the way, Jeff, it looks like the Chinese satellite may come crashing down in southern Michigan. You're lucky you're no longer a student there. He's got a PhD in astronomy from the University of Hawaii. And he was a professor in planetary science there at their Institute for Geophysics. He did research on mineralogical composition of asteroids from visible and IR reflection spectroscopy, and he was a science team member, Comet Rendezvous asteroid flyby spacecraft, and PI on several other missions. He writes opinion columns, and he does interviews, and he is opinionated and extremely well researched and thought out. Even if you don't like his ideas, they are solid. And he's a no-nonsense guy and really a good guest on the space show. So, Jeff, welcome back, and how are you doing, my friend?
Well, I'm doing pretty good, except for all of my telephone, internet, and cable TV having all failed.
So, as an astronomer, is Mercury by chance in retrograde as we're doing this show?
I don't keep track of the planets anymore. It's tough with you live in a big city with those streetlights.
Because if it's in retrograde, isn't that supposed to screw up our communications, according to all the astrologists? So maybe that's an explanation for it. What do you think? No comment on that one. You'd rather comment on why Red Dragon's not going to Mars with SpaceX, yeah, right?
Well, first I'll comment that if the Chinese space station falls in southern Michigan, fortunately there's nothing vital there for it to hit.
Okay, I'm not familiar with southern Michigan geography, so I don't know what's there or not there, but
we have lots of abandoned worn out auto plants and lots of dairy farms. Yeah.
So the cows might get hit.
Yeah, well, one of my favorite TV shows is this a show called Dr. Paul. He's a veterinarian in central lower Michigan. And
yeah,
I watch the show just to keep track of how things are there and make sure I'll never move back there.
I wonder if you can keep debris from the space station. I know you can't from an American object that crashes. The government wants all that, but I wonder if you'd be able to keep a souvenir piece of the debris from the Chinese station.
Yeah, under the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, every piece of space junk belongs to the country of launch.
So it has to go back to China if they want it.
Right. Just like the few times that classified American space junk has fallen, it has to go back to the NRO.
Well, so no cow can keep
it. Before that treaty, there actually was a U.S. Air Force organization. It was started out as a squadron, I think later was upgraded to a group, whose job was to go around and pick up space junk. And that organization did not always return it to the country of origin.
Interesting.
And that may still be true today, that if your space junk falls into the hands of a secret intelligence organization, it may not come back.
Well, we will see where the station comes down. I guess we'll start to know more as we get closer to that window, which is, I guess, about a two-week window around the early part of April. But tell us why Red Dragon's not going to Mars.
Well, I told you that like a year ago or in one of my appearances.
Yeah, a long time ago, it seems like.
A long time ago, I said that, you know, this project wouldn't work because Dragon was designed to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere, and that shape was wrong for entering the atmosphere of Mars, which is like 100 times thinner and a lot more extended vertically than because the gravity is lower. This was all studied in detail back in the 1960s by two different groups, JPL, which was designing American Mars landers, and Lavochkin in Moscow, which had the work done at SAGI, the Central Aero Hydrodynamical Institute. And both these groups concluded that you needed a very extended drag disk on your spacecraft in order to get down to a low altitude at a low enough speed that you could deploy a parachute for the final descent. And I pointed this out on the show, and somebody, I think maybe it was you, remonstrated with me because saying that Elon Musk and his engineers couldn't be that stupid. They must have worked it out, and they must have a way to do it. Well, the way they thought out to do it was to use rocket thrust during the entry to bring the deceleration up to a higher level. But that's not a very efficient way of landing. It's possible to do it. And again, I've seen a wind tunnel film from the 60s where some NASA center, probably JPL, was testing the idea of firing a rocket engine out of an Apollo-style reentry module during reentry into the supersonic or hypersonic airflow hitting the bottom of the vehicle. And they concluded that that was possible, but it was not very efficient. As Elon said when he announced that Red Dragon was dead, it turned out that to make that work, the Red Dragon would have to be completely filled with propellant tanks, and there was no room left for any cargo. The other reason he gave was that for the manned Dragon, which they're still developing for the space station ferry mission, NASA had rejected the idea of landing the spacecraft on land with rocket thrusters. And they had to switch to parachutes for the land landing. And I don't quite understand why that means that Red Dragon couldn't have used thrusters. I think the first reason he gave is the big reason, because it was the reason I gave back at the start of the project.
So that's the incompatibility of the design for the Martian atmosphere.
Yeah, you need to design different vehicles for different atmospheres. It doesn't work like it does in science fiction novels where, you know, the same spacecraft lands and takes off from every planet, especially if it's a lifting body or a wing spacecraft. The wing loading and all the aerodynamic features have to be adapted to the specific atmospheric density and the altitude profile and the entry speeds you're going to be coming in at. This is a basic fact of engineering. JPL has recent years had published several interesting articles on this with cool graphs that show the exact limits of landing things on Mars. And one of their conclusions is that the conventional technique has just about reached its mass limit with the latest Mars rovers, and that if you go to something larger, like a manned lander, you might have to do some long-term research to come up with a different way of doing it. The idea of taking basically an Apollo-style or Soyuz-style descent module and using it on Mars was just not going to work.
Okay, so let's take it a little step further, and I'm playing true confessions here and confessing that I'm not the closest follower of SpaceX announcements, but I do see that they intend, whether they will or not is another story, but they intend, or at least the rhetoric now is there, that he's going to start test flights next year. And Mars around 2021, 2022.
You mean for Big Fantasy Rocket?
Big Falcon Rocket. Okay, let's be somewhat conservative and respectful for the time being. As the show goes longer and longer, you can go off in different directions.
Well, I like to use my own private terminology.
I understand. Most people have a different word than even fantasy for the an acronym. But anyway, how is he planning to land his hundreds, if not thousands, of people on Mars as his taxi is carrying and ferrying all these people from Earth to Mars at some point in the future? So I don't know the answer to that. Legitimately, I don't know the answer to that.
Well, in his original presentation at Guadalajara, he showed a computer fluid dynamics modeling showing the vehicle or the upper stage or whatever you want to call it with tiny little tail fins entering Mars's atmosphere at a fairly high angle of attack and making a lifting, flying, space shuttle-style reentry. And then at the end of that, the thing was supposed to pull up into a hammerhead turn or maybe just flip around backwards in place and make the final landing with rocket engines, with fuel they carried along all the way from Earth. And then, of course, the vehicle would be empty, and they would gas it up from the fuel manufacturing plant on Mars to take off back for Earth.
So he's going to land it like a space shuttle would land on Mars.
Well, really, the X-33 is more of a good analogy for what he seemed to want to do. And, again, this brings up the issue. This same vehicle is supposed to land on Earth. Not only is the passenger version supposed to land on Earth using the same kind of lifting reentry at a very high velocity, much higher than what the space shuttle would use, it's supposed to land on Earth using the same technique. Right? It flies a long, low-G lifting reentry, and then when it gets close to the launch base, it somehow turns over, fires its engines, settles back down onto the launch pad, exactly onto the mounts which supported it before launch.
Okay.
So it developed a lot of expertise in turning vehicles around and firing the engines opposite to the wind blast. So that's probably not the part that will be dangerous, but in the early phases of this reentry, again, you've got the problem. It's supposed to work on Mars, and it's supposed to work on Earth, where there's 100 times more air. Now, the situation is a lot different than it would have been with Red Dragon. Not only is it more lifting, higher lift-to-drag reentry, again, judging by the simulation he showed, but the vehicle's wing loading, if you want to call it that, is a lot lower because it's mostly empty fuel tank, both landing on Mars and then landing on Earth. And also there's a tanker version, remember, of this upper stage, which flies up and down, you know, several times, many times, for each trip to Mars, and that vehicle has to land at an even lighter landing weight because it'll all be empty fuel tanks. There'll be no passenger accommodations or life support on board. So this, I think, is probably the biggest obstacle in Big Falcon Rocket is the reentry aspect of it. Also the fact that this enormous tank has to be protected against reentry heating, which was one of the things that killed the flyback booster for the space shuttle back around 1971, is that if you put super alloy shingles or even full up shuttle tile over something that big, it was just too heavy to fly.
Well,
so a lot of people, criticized the 42 engines in the first stage, which I guess is now only 31 engines.
And
Another aspect of it, like the fact that it has to be refueled on Mars. So, I mean, obviously the original first generation of BFR has to be different. It has to take its own fuel generating plant along to Mars to establish the fuel generating station. Obviously, the version he showed at Guadalajara is not going to be the one that establishes the initial base on Mars.
And now that seems to have given way to the one he showed in Australia.
Yeah, well, another interesting feature of that is that the tail fins have grown into little wings. And again, that's very reminiscent of X-33. X-33 started out with tiny little tail fins, and they kept getting bigger and developing more control surfaces. And at the end of X-33, they were, basically winglets, very much like the ones on this latest version of BFR. And what was going on there is that the engines, the linear aerospike engines, got much heavier in development because Aerojet originally designed them with some lightweight aluminum alloy, and it turned out that that wasn't good enough. They had to use a heavier copper-based alloy. And the engines had never really been developed in the ground tests they did back in the 60s and 70s weren't really very realistic. And so the center of gravity of the vehicle kept moving aft, right? So that means you have to move the center of pressure of the vehicle aft to maintain stability. And so eventually, the wings got, or fins, or whatever you call them at the back, got very large, and basically to hold up the heavy engines during the reentry. And this was one of several factors that killed X-33. Those fins got too big and too heavy and too draggy, and eventually it looked like the vehicle wouldn't even be able to make its supposed test flight from Edwards Air Force Base to Montana. Just because the performance had decayed and the weight had gotten heavy. And so this latest Australia presentation, you can see that BFR is going through the same process that led X-33 into a brick wall.
Are you optimistic that he'll start test flights of the BFR next year, like you said at South by Southwest a day ago?
Well, even Elon admits that his schedules are wildly optimistic. In fact, I think he said so at the same statement. Nobody outside the extreme Space Cadet, SpaceX fanboy community takes this BFR project seriously.
Wow, everybody I hear takes it seriously. They just don't have any clue what it'll look like as a finished product or when it might be finished. I think the timeline is where they're more skeptical rather than the completion of the project. And they're skeptical about the suborbital aspect that he showed in point to point.
Let's talk about that, because every couple of years somebody brings up this idea of using a space plane type vehicle or a reusable booster in the suborbital mode to carry billionaires between the major cities. And again, this has very serious problems that are not obvious to a lot of people. In the first place, for a long trip like let's say Cheyenne, Wyoming to Moscow, just to choose two a random missile base and a random target. When Atlas was designed for that requirement, the original Atlases were all based near Cheyenne.
Right.
It turned out that the energy you need for that is almost as much as you need to go into orbit. And this is why NASA was able to take the 4.5-megaton warhead off of Atlas D and put on a manned space capsule and put the manned space capsule into orbit. Right? The capsule didn't have to be all that much lighter than the original warhead in order to make the Mercury missions, Mercury Atlas missions possible. So unless you're going for a short hop, you know, like say Warsaw to Moscow or West Germany to Moscow, your vehicle has to be pretty much as capable as an orbital vehicle. So when you're designing a suborbital commercial passenger or freight transport vehicle, you're basically designing an orbital vehicle, right?
Well, I know that to be the fact, and so do many of my listeners, but many of the space advocates and those that follow, what SpaceX talks about, they don't buy that. And they believe you could, for example, launch a rocket in San Francisco and fly it west to Japan against the spin of the Earth, and they don't believe that the sound is as big an issue for the BFR or some of the other issues, and that getting permissions to have a ballistic reentry into many different major cities wouldn't be as challenging as many people think. So I think the suborbital component of that is a total non-starter.
Yeah.
But I would say it's 50-50 among my listeners, and I'm not an engineer, so you know my opinion's worth something. But you know, I'm not giving you an aerospace engineering opinion.
Look at a proposal a few years ago that was made by the Pentagon, right?
By the who?
By
the who? I didn't hear what you said. The who?
The Pentagon made
the
proposal.
The Pentagon. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Actually, it was mostly the Navy, but they wanted to take some of the Trident II missiles out in the Ohio-class missile submarines and replace the multiple thermonuclear warheads with a conventional Earth-penetrating warhead. So that if you suddenly found out that Osama bin Laden was a particular set of coordinates, you could blast that particular cave before he moved away. And this was based on an important fiasco before the Afghanistan war, where we actually received information that Osama bin Laden was at a particular terrorist training camp in Pakistan or Afghanistan, I forget which it was. But by the time the Tomahawk cruise missiles launched by the Navy had crossed over Pakistan and arrived at that training camp, Osama had left. Right, so everybody said, well, you know, subsonic cruise missiles are not fast enough to deal with the modern elusive target. We need to have a ballistic missile that will get there in 30 minutes or less, guaranteed your money back. Well, Congress killed that program, and they killed it every time it was proposed. And the reason they killed it was that these ballistic missiles with attacks would look just like a thermonuclear ballistic missile attack. And the people capable of detecting such a thing, mainly the Russians and possibly the Chinese, might mistake it for a real attack. And in fact, around that same time, Boris Yeltsin's military advisors told him that there was a ballistic missile attack on Moscow from an American submarine in the Arctic Sea which turned out to be a sounding rocket launch from Norway, which the Norwegians had informed the Russian Space Force about in advance, but the letter got lost in the shuffle somewhere, right?
Yeah.
So your issue of getting permission to operate a large ballistic vehicle regularly around the Earth is a big issue. But the real issue arrives at the end of the trajectory, right?
Right.
What happens with the Atlas or the Trident II or any missile, right? The stages fall off, right? The MIRV final stage falls off, and only a tiny little warhead, which is heavily protected, plunges into the atmosphere at like Mach 22. It slows down with a deceleration of hundreds of Gs, hits the ground at about Mach 6 if it's properly streamlined. Right. Obviously, you can't do that with the passenger vehicle, right? The passenger vehicle has to slow down much more gradually so the passengers and the cargo are not crushed. Well, how do you do that? You have to turn around and fire your engine a lot more with fuel you don't have, or you need to have some kind of lifting reentry. You have a gradual reentry, right?
Right.
Well, you can't do that at the typical intercontinental entry angle. It's about 20 degrees when the ICBM approaches Moscow from Cheyenne. It's at about 20 degrees above the horizon, right? And that's one reason why the reentry is so crushing, and the warhead has to be specially designed and tested in centrifuges so that it won't be crushed by the G-forces because you're coming in too steep. The Mercury capsule entered from orbit at about 8 degrees angle above the horizon. And at that, the astronaut was hit with about 8 Gs of peak deceleration. Now, even eyeballs in, like in the Mercury capsule, the average passenger probably wouldn't tolerate that. At 20 degrees, you have to make a very sharp pull-up in order to flatten out and lose your speed more gradually, right? So instead of being crushed against the back of your seat, I'm assuming the passengers would face aft like they do in military aircraft, you'd be crushed towards the bottom of your seat in the eyeball down configuration.
I have a listener question for you on this topic. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's related to this topic. This is from Doug in Southern California. Does the greater volume to surface ratio of large craft such as the VFS make a single stage to orbit more feasible?
No, size doesn't. Just size doesn't help you much there. There is a strong curve of cost versus size in rocket boosters, which is why these lightweight boosters that have been proposed over and over again over my lifetime always have a very limited market and launch at a very slow rate because there's a certain fixed overhead in every satellite launch, which you want to spread out over a larger payload or a larger number of small payloads. This is why most of these CubeSats and LightSats and DebrisSats are being launched in giant dispensers on medium or large boosters, and very few of them are being launched on these light boosters. But in terms of performance, just making a single-stage booster bigger is not going to give you single-stage-to-orbit performance. There's the square cube law is kind of working in your favor there because as you double the length of the booster, the volume goes up by the cube of two. And the surface area only goes up as the square of two. but that doesn't really apply to the internal structure, right? You have to make the surface area, the surface structure thicker to hold on the weight and pressure of all that fuel, especially under IG acceleration. So, yeah, single stage of orbit, it really requires unobtainium. Something, strength to weight ratio is much better than what we have today.
Years ago when I was doing my doctoral dissertation, and one of my advisors was the top guy at Stanford in the satellite engineering group. His name was Dr. Bruce Lucinian. He's since retired. And I taught some of his classes on economics and things of that nature regarding launches. But he had his class designing reusable spaceships, because if you remember at the time, at the end of the 1990s, all the commercial guys, and there were a lot of them around back then, Rocket Plane and a whole bunch of others, they were talking about space tourism vehicles to orbit, not suborbital. Nobody ever talked suborbital back then. And all of them were SSTO, single stage to orbit. And so Bruce said, that's all BS. They're not going to go single stage to orbit for the reasons you're talking about and many other people have talked about. So he had his class design an SSTO and a half vehicle, and he wrote manuals about it with his class. I don't know if I still have copies of them or not. They were paperback and bounded kind of like with vellum binding or something like that, you know, that his class did. He was proposing a Stanford version of an SSTO and a half. And here's the kicker. He was using a Boeing 747 hull because he said that was probably about 85 to 90% of the integrity needed to go to space and to do orbital flight, and that it could be beefed up from there to, you know, being 100%. You know, his class did a lot of research on an SSTO and a half, and I provided him with some very tentative economics, because all of this is fantasy in the sky, as you know. He was absolutely teaching his class at the time that there's no way you're going to do SSTO, single stage to orbit. And I guess that's the
point. Yeah, around that same time, we had some a couple of lavishly funded, government-funded programs to build SSTO.
And what happened to them and the privates that were raising money? And none of them.
Well, what happened to the government programs is the Soviet Union collapsed, the Star Wars program was canceled, and so we didn't need to have fake SSTO programs anymore to make credible the fake Star Wars anti-missile program.
Well, they got it deployed around the area of North Korea, and I guess it has about a 60% success rate whenever they test it, right? Something like that, the THAAD system and whatever other components there are.
Well, there's THAAD, but here in Hawaii we have SM-3 Block 2A, better known as Aegis Ashore, and one of those ABM systems has just gone operational in Romania. Another one will be operational later this year in Poland.
But they don't always hit the target.
Well, Aegis Ashore has a pretty good result in tests of barking sands. Remember the cruiser Lake Erie shot down that failing spacecraft there a few years ago. And this Block 2 vehicle, which is going to be installed in Poland, has a much higher performance because the success to Aegis SM-3 is that it's based on a very long-running, successful anti-aircraft missile program, right? And it's never been developed from zero like THAAD or GBI, the George Bush Interceptor. Both those have fairly low success rates and tests, which aren't all that challenging. But with the new SM-3, they've removed the wings, which it used to use to maneuver inside the atmosphere to catch airplanes, and made the second stage much bigger. And so it can shoot down satellites at operational altitudes. And that's, the Russians are absolutely livid about Agus ashore. They constantly cite these two bases in Europe as a sinister American plot. In fact, it's two sinister American plots. One is that these missiles shoot down their missiles and render their nuclear deterrent ineffective. And the other one is that they notice that the launch cells for SM-3 are also can be used to launch Tomahawk missiles. And so they claim these bases are really camouflaged offensive missile bases, violating the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty of 1987. But of course, they're developing their own land-launched cruise missile, which violates the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. So, as usual, they're just accusing us of doing something illegal that they're doing to justify their breaking the treaty.
Going a little bit deeper into some of the issues that that you're wanting to talk about, and I guess some of this is not really on your list, but I don't want to leave the BFR kind of open-ended. So are you optimistic that it will fly, that it will get to Mars at anywhere near what he talks about the cost being, and on the kind of timeline that Musk kind of indicates it may be? Will it be an answer, say, to SLS? Many people think we should just cancel SLS right away and go with the BFR, for example.
Well, yeah, maybe I'm not the person to ask, because I don't really believe in any manned spaceflight program as a role in the 21st century. But yeah, this vehicle is far too ambitious. It's too big and too expensive, and will take a long, long time to develop. And Elon admitted in his original presentation that he doesn't have the money to develop it. Now, since then, he's received large amounts of investment capital, supposedly $800 million last year alone. Now, maybe he's using that money to develop BFR. Maybe he's using it to cover the losses in his Falcon 9 business. I don't know. You know, the finances of Elon's of SpaceX are a complete mystery. Even the Wall Street Journal has been unable to find out very much about it.
Well, it's a private company, so he doesn't have to release financial data.
Yes, so I guess that these angel investors who are giving him $800 million a year...
Well, they get data, I'm sure. They get disclosure documentation and financials, but it's probably all under NDA and very privately held.
Right, well, they're not buying stock in the company then, right?
They're just No, they're buying stock. It's just not publicly traded stock. So if they have an initial public offering down the road, then they will make that stock into public stock, and that will be the exit strategy for many of those investors. They'll sell their stock into publicly registered common stock, and hopefully they'll make a killing at whatever ratio they can get for it. But yeah, they're issued private restricted stock that cannot be sold on the open market.
And until they go to public stock, they don't have to comply with hardly any SEC requirements.
Well, yes and no. They have to provide documentation and financial information to qualified investors, which anyone in SpaceX is by a million times over, because he deals with professionals in the venture capital industry and all that. They demand, and they do get, audited financials, and you can't fudge that stuff or lie about it or commit fraud. The penalties for doing that, even on a private placement, could result in huge fines and jail sentences. So they get what the public would get except that it's private, and they sign documentation like non-disclosure agreements to where they agree to keep all this information confidential and private among the private investors. But they are provided the same kind of documentation that would be made available to public investors if they registered the stock in an initial public offering. It's just that it's really tightly held and tightly controlled information, and nobody ever leaks this stuff. It's very doubtful that someone would secretly hand the brochure of financial documents to the Wall Street Journal. I can't imagine any of these private players would do anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we don't know who these private players are, so we don't know how much they know about space travel or...
Well, you do know who the big investment companies are that are doing it, like Fidelity and others. And you could probably, I don't know that Fidelity, say, would give you the list of their investors in that particular fund. But, you know, people invest in venture capital funds. You can invest in a Fidelity venture capital fund that may have a position in SpaceX. I'm not 100% sure about that. But they know who the big venture capital people are, and you see their names appear in the press all the time from people in Silicon Valley and all of that that are investing in people from other countries that have invested. So, yeah, we do know largely who the players are. Many of them are on the board of directors for SpaceX. They do have a board of directors. So it's not as mysterious and secretive as one might think. It's just not publicly registered information. And until they become a publicly traded stock, there is no legal requirement for them to release like 10Q documents quarterly or public papers or an annual report or anything like that. But the state corporation commissions and the SEC have rules for private investments as well that they comply with. It's just that there's no push to put any of that stuff out in the public limelight.
Well, my big doubt about BFR is, what's the problem it's solving? Who is its customer base?
Well, I asked that on the show the other day, okay, and I did the same thing for SLS. And it appears that the customer base for these big rockets, including Bezos, if he makes one of the big rockets, is there what they decide to do with it themselves. So, for example, the BFR would be Musk and his use of it for transporting all these people to Mars that he wants to do. And SLS, the market would be the government using it for its one mission a year, maybe two missions a year, for whatever the government deemed it would be used for. And Bezos wants to have O'Neillian colonies in orbit in space. He believes that's the way to settle space rather than go to the moon or Mars. So his market would be what he could do to bring people up to an O'Neillian space station. So I don't think there are, and we talked about this yesterday, I don't think there are any competitive arm's length customers out there wanting to book a BFR, okay, or an SLS. I think the market is what these companies can do with it, at least early on. Now, if they're successful, will independent third party commercial people step up to the plate and say they want to reserve a ride on BFR to do this, and this. And I don't see any indication of that even being considered, but it could happen if Musk is wildly successful in using the BFR internally for his Martian goals, and the rocket is successful at doing that, and the real operating cost, which he would be able to show and could be verified, are as low as he indicates that they will be. You might see a true independent commercial market for that kind of heavy lift develop. I'm not seeing it yet, but that's just me.
No, I don't think it's there. I mean, you know, how many people did Boz Lansdorp get to sign up for his Mars One colony
but
project?
In my humble opinion, I got to phrase this carefully because I like Boz. He's a great guest on the space show, and I'd bring him back any time. But listen, I don't know if Mars One is an intentional scam or not, but listen, Southwest Airlines will forever and a day fly higher than anything related to Mars One. Okay, so...
But let's face it, Mars One and Musk's
they raise a lot
Mars
of money.
Colony program are drawing from the same pool of Mars cadets.
Yeah, but Musk is a different category of person with a different intention, and he's got his
but
own
you really
money
mean
that he's
a lot richer.
He's a lot richer,
right?
And I think he's a professional business guy, and Boss is I don't think there's any comparison between Mars One and Musk other than
well, I haven't heard about Mars One for a long time, so maybe
no. Well, I get their
it.
No. I'm on their mailing list for their newsletters. I get their newsletters all the time, and they're very active, much more so active in international arena in international markets than they are in the United States. But no, they're active and they're. I should invite him to come back on the show. They're still going strong with their plan, and they just, you know, the disadvantage he has among many is that he has to buy services, including a launch, from whoever has the capability to launch him, whereas Musk is building his own rocket to do all of this in-house.
Yeah. Well, he's building his own rocket, but he's not building or developing any of the other stuff. By stuff, I mean high technology
that we know
we need
about
for these people to survive on Mars after they get there.
I agree.
And when people ask him about that, he says, "Well, that's somebody else's job."
Well,
nobody else is doing it.
He draws on NASA's human factors research and life support research. We know that for a fact. And I don't know what he intends to do for life support and human factors design of the spaceflight capsule that's going to have the people in it, because there's a lot of design and medical stuff that goes together. The doctors and the engineers work pretty closely to design all of that. I don't, you know, he doesn't talk about that, so we don't really know. And I don't know what he's doing on life support, and maybe he's got a way around these issues. He clearly knows about the issues. He talks to the people at NASA about life support. He talks to the Planetary Protection Office. He knows about planetary protection in Article 9. So, I'm sure he will have some mitigation strategies. And when he talked, I don't know if anybody saw his talk on South by Southwest the other day. You can watch it. It's about an hour and a half on YouTube. He talks about taking people to Mars, and there's a really good chance you will be killed and you will never return. So maybe his disclosure strategy is real simple. If you go on this mission, you can die or be turned into a vegetable if you're able to return, and sign on the bottom line. So maybe that's sufficient. I don't know. But he talked about that at South by Southwest and says, and the guy interviewing him says, you know, how do you find people to go when you're telling them, you know, that there's a good chance they're going to die? And so Musk talks about that at South by Southwest and responds to the guy interviewing him's questions about that. People can go get it on YouTube, and it's already up. It's about an hour and a half. There's several versions of it that you can watch. So I don't know what the strategy is, but maybe the disclosure is just to say, you can die, we're going to do the best we can, but no guarantees, everybody.
Yeah, this in the orbital tourism market, you know, I brought this up years ago, and their answer was that everyone will assign a release.
Well,
everyone will assign a release.
Yeah, they're required by law to sign a release. You know,
right.
There's an informed consent requirement.
But the kind of people that they were going to recruit for suborbital tourism were very rich people with very rich relatives who could assemble huge legal talent to challenge those.
Listen.
Because they would say there wasn't informed consent. We didn't know about this flaw in the vehicle, which caused everyone to be killed. It wasn't properly regulated by the government. So you don't have that defense.
Well, I have covered this with so many space attorneys since 2004 when the informed consent thing came up, and it's not as simple as what you're saying. So first of all, the relatives may not have any claims at all. It's even questionable if the children or the spouse would have a claim, but there is probably a likely scenario where children of age and spouses will have to acknowledge the informed consent agreements as well. Although that even that's doubtful, but you know, people can pierce the informed consent stuff all the time, and they do it, you know, for amusement park rides and helicopter skiing, you know, when they go hunting by helicopter and, you know, things like that. I'm sure this helicopter that crashed in the East River, that everybody's going to sue the hell out of the helicopter company, and everybody signed informed consent agreements to ride on that photography-oriented helicopter ride last night, and they all died. I'm sure their families are going to go after them. And they probably will ultimately prevail in some way or another. But it, you know, the 2004 Act spells out the informed consent and the basics about what is in it. The law has evolved since that 2004, and I would direct people to listen to two recent space show programs on this, and one was with Laura Montgomery about her first show when she was on the show, and the other one is with this incredible adventure attorney. She's out of Alaska, but she does a lot of informed consent for really high-risk, crazy things like bungee jumping and, you know, helicopter skiing and stuff like that. Her name is Tracy Knutson, K-N-U-T-S-O-N. And you can hear how the law is changing and what the insurance companies are doing to protect themselves from liability when people want to do these crazy, wild adventures. And I would think going to Mars would probably by an insurance company be considered a crazy wild thing. So all of this is kind of up in the air, and there'll probably be some settlement of approaches by the time anyone's ready to fly to Mars with Musk, or God, you know, if Mars One ever did happen. But it's not clear cut that relatives and people mentioned in a will are going to have a chance to go after an operator. You know, it's a developing area, and all I can say is I really, if people are interested in this and you want the cutting-edge information, both Tracy and Laura were on the program last year, so their information is still current, including what they said about the actions and behavior insurance companies are taking to stop paying out claims on risky accident things that happen with people who want to do crazy things and take big risks, like diving with a shark tank, for example, or something like that. So stay tuned, I guess, is the way to say it. It is an evolving field, and I would assume the SpaceX attorneys and any other company attorneys that are going to be preparing these documents will be really adept at it. And I wouldn't be surprised if they don't videotape disclosures with the passengers and the people, you know, to cover their bases, including spouses. So, you know, to mitigate losses, because really, if once they say you can die or become a vegetable if you make this flight, and you decide to make that flight, you've been disclosed that you may die. I mean, what more can you say, right?
Yeah, well, I don't really think that these insurance and liability problems are going to stop.
No, I don't think they'll stop anybody.
I don't think that the question of people signing up to go to Mars is ever going to arise, because I don't think the technical capability will exist in Musk's hands or anybody else's, and I don't think there's a big enough pool of people who want to go to Mars.
No, I think people will go to Mars. I'm hoping Jeff, it's in my lifetime. I'm 72, and so, you know, in 10 or 12 years, you know, I'll be in my early 80s if I'm still around. I would love to see it. I'd like to see people go to Mars. I think it'd be great. Whether it's Musk or somebody else that will emerge, that will take them, I do think it will happen. I have no idea what the outcome will be. But you've got another email. Actually, you got a couple of them, and I'm kind of remiss in not keeping the show going. But this is from Doug again in Southern California. Elon has indicated that the BFS will be able to single stage to orbit, presumably with no payload, but enough propellant to deorbit and land. Do you think that is possible? And if not, would you be willing to come back on the space show to explain yourself if he succeeds? P.S. I myself don't claim that he will be successful with SSTO, nor do I think it necessarily. I think it necessary for a useful BFR. So.
So does he mean using the second stage of
Well,
the vehicle?
He says BFS. So I'm assuming. I wish he could call, but sometimes he doesn't have a good phone line and or he's at work. Elon has indicated that the BFS will be able to single stage to orbit, presumably with no payload, but enough propellant to deorbit and land. Do you think that is possible?
No, I don't think so, because it's, you know, proved impossible every time it's been tried before.
And, I mean, all I can say, Doug, and again, you know, I'm not an engineer, but everything I got in studying this and talking to engineers and interviewing people when I was doing my dissertation, I know that's old now, but maybe not all that old, is that single stage to orbit was not viable. And you don't see any single stage to orbit vehicles that I'm aware of. So.
And before somebody talks about new technology, there's no new technology has come along since the 90s that would make it any more feasible.
I don't think so. The chemical fuels are all the same.
Oh, speaking of fuels, propellants.
Yeah.
Right, rocket
uh-huh.
propellants. A couple times on this show, we've talked about a book, the history of rocket propellant development in the U.S. called Ignition! Exclamation mark. And this book, which for a long time has cost thousands of dollars in used bookstores, is being reprinted. And you can pre-order it on Amazon right now.
Yeah, it's about $25. It's being reprinted by Rutgers, who I think printed the first book, right?
I've never seen the first book. Well, they have one in the university library in my neighborhood, and I think I actually did check that out and read it back before they discovered that my library card had expired in 2002.
It's a classic book, listeners, and I've ordered a copy of it, and several other listeners have ordered it as well because I've read Jeff's emails on different shows about it since he's the one who called my attention to it. So it is... I don't think anything's come along that negates what's in the book, but again, this is not my field, and I defer to aerospace engineers and rocket people who really know what they're talking about.
Yeah, well, this book is really about the golden age of rocket propellant research when money was unlimited and everything was tested for its usability as a rocket fuel.
Okay.
And that age was pretty much over by the time the book was published, and as far as I know, nothing really new has come along since then, except for this latest mania for green rocket fuels, which so far hasn't really produced an effective replacement for the old non-green rocket fuels.
Okay, so Jeff, you have a blog comment that came in. So anyone can go read it on the blog. It's by a gentleman named Henk, H-E-N-K. I'm not going to read it because it's a personal attack against you email. But I'm going to use it as an example and say, Henk, you would do much better and you would do credit to yourself rather than to discredit yourself by personally attacking Jeff by factually telling us why you think the way you do about what Jeff is saying, rather than just simply letting it all go and calling him names. You haven't made your case. You've made yourself into kind of a fool, and you've engaged in a flaming personal attack. So I'm going to leave your blog comment on the blog, and it is an example of what I personally object to about the blogosphere, but I invite you to repost your comment, or it would be a new comment, and since you clearly don't respect or think highly of anything Jeff is saying, factually tell us where Jeff is going wrong. What's wrong, in your opinion, with what he's saying? And if you can support what you're saying factually, fine. And if it's just your opinion, that's welcome too. Tell us it's just your opinion. But give us the specifics rather than just calling Jeff names, okay? And Hank, I hope you will do that, because if you disagree with someone, that's cool. Tell us why. What is there about what he's saying that you want to disagree with? And Doug sent in another note. If Elon achieves SSTO, he's again asking you this, Jeff. He wants your commitment. Will you return to the show to explain yourself? So, Jeff, first of all, I ask Jeff to come on the show all the time. So the likely scenario is that he would be returning to the show. He does seem to answer all the questions and not duck the ball. But, Jeff, in order to make Doug's day, if Elon achieves SSTO, when you return as a guest to the space show, will you, explain yourself? I guess what he really means, acknowledge that you were wrong. I think maybe.
Sure.
That's a better way of saying it, because there's not much to explain here. He achieved SSTO. This is how he did it, and you were wrong.
Sure.
Okay, Doug, are you happy? So if you can send me what do they call those little things that people, you know, do in email signatures and stuff, send me one of those with hands clapping, and then we'll know you're happy. Emojis with clapping hands. So, you know, that posted on the blog would seem to work. We're way past where we should have taken a break. So, we're going to skip the break. But let me take a moment to thank I actually did thank all our sponsors up front. So I don't have to worry about that. You have another email. Are you still there? I heard a click on the phone.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of clicks at my end, considering that.
Thomas is in Germany, and he sent in a note ahead of the show, and we're going to change topics here, and that's why I've kind of waited until now, since we're changing the topics. So he has several questions, but all of these are about what he's learning about the dispute over the 30-meter telescope, okay, that around the Hawaiian cultural issues. So he says, I just read a news article in the Hawaii Business Magazine as of March 7th of this year. Who should manage and protect Mauna Kea? By Noel Fuji, and he gives a link to this article. And then he says, as the decision on where to build the 30-meter telescope is said to be due in April of this year, do you still think, number one, that it's going to be built in Hawaii?
I don't follow that dispute, because I'm naturally highly prejudiced in favor of the scientists rather than the multicultural monarchist activists. As far as I can tell, this dispute, like everything else connected with Native Hawaiians, involves the tortuous internal politics of the Native Hawaiian community. And this crops up over and over again, especially since the last Constitutional Convention established a state agency, the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, with a huge budget to supposedly take care of all of the complaints of the Native Hawaiians. And, of course, that has, like all previous attempts, has evolved into a huge corruption scandal, like every government agency in Hawaii. But there's there's a split in that, many splits in that community. The main one is between monarchists and Marxists, right? And there's a large community who insists that the Hawaiian Kingdom still exists. It didn't exist when Queen Lil abdicated. It didn't cease to exist. Last year, a guy in the Office of Hawaiian Affairs actually sent a letter to, it was 2 years ago, to John Kerry at the State Department asking what the official State Department position was on the continued existence of the Hawaiian Kingdom.
Did Kerry respond?
No, and in fact, cooler heads at OHA immediately sent a letter canceling the first letter and requesting it not be shown to the Secretary of State. it's an ongoing comedy here in Hawaii to watch the Native Hawaiian community fight with itself over all these issues. Of course, there's another faction which is very progressive and liberal and cultural Marxist, in my terminology, and and then there's, of course, there's a split between the Hawaiians who were Christian and the ones who have gone back to paganism, and the pagans play a big role in this 30-meter telescope controversy. Things in Hawaii are so crazy these days in Hawaiian government and the state government that I cannot predict what will happen.
But you would want it to stay in Hawaii on Mauna Kea, right? That would be your choice.
Yeah, because we need good jobs here, and we need not to develop a reputation as being an anti-science place, an anti-modern place, which has always been a big problem in Hawaii. People do not take it seriously as a place for science or even industry.
He also wanted to know if you had any opinion on the alternative home, which seems to be the Canary Islands.
Well, it's not as good. You know, the mountain is not as high. The weather is not as good. It's a similar location, you know, isolated mountain in the middle of the ocean, which, you know, for a long time we've realized is the best place for optical telescopes.
And then,
and it's not in the United States.
He also says, do you think the University of Hawaii has not made a good job in managing Mauna Kea in the past? Or have they done a good job?
And generally, all they do is that they, you know, allow outside entities to set up facilities there and, you know, charge them a fee either in money or in observing time on the telescopes for UH faculty.
Yeah.
And they provide general services. And while I was going over there, the first days the services were very minimal and housing was primitive and food was weird. But I've heard things have gotten a lot better since I took my medical retirement and stopped going over there.
He has an independent question, not related to the 30-meter telescope. As Falcon 9 Heavy... So I don't know what the Falcon 9 Heavy is. Does that just mean Falcon Heavy?
That's the booster. That's the triple barrel version, the one I call Falcon 27.
So that's the Falcon Heavy that just launched the Roadster into the direction of Mars.
Right. And
okay.
I won't talk about that.
You do want to talk about that?
No, I don't want to talk about it because it's so self-evidently silly and renders the launch test meaningless. That I'm going to talk about it.
Okay. So you don't want to tell us why it's meaningless then?
Well, it's not a meaningful payload and it's not a meaningful orbit. A real test to convince people that it's safe for expensive commsats and intelligence satellites would be to launch a dummy payload, a mass model of an average commsat, into synchronous orbit, right? Track it for a while, and then move it out into a graveyard orbit, right? This is what the Russians did with their Angara 5 test a couple of years ago, right? This is what you do to establish confidence in your customer base is you fly a real mission, a real trajectory with a real dummy, cheap payload that nobody will miss if it burns up. Right? This is not the kind of, this roadster thing is not the kind of thing you do if you want to be taken seriously as a launch provider. It's a silly publicity stunt.
Okay, so.
I saw one online comment that said, gee, how far have we fallen since 1961 from launching actual men into space to launching mannequins into space?
Well.
But that's kind of unfair because actually mannequins were launched in both Vostok and Mercury program in advance of the actual man or even the monkeys.
Let me read his question, though. As Falcon 9 Heavy will be a subject anyway, I would like to know Dr. Bell's opinion on the subject in his backyard. I'm not sure I understand this, but... That's what his question reads. Do you have a way of responding to that?
Well, I don't really know what it means, but yeah, I think we need to have a second heavy lift booster besides Delta IV heavy. That's clearly why the Air Force is supporting this program. It has such a big capacity that I think it will have limited commercial appeal, but if the Air Force decides that it's safe for their, you know, irreplaceable limited production satellites, it would be very useful, and who knows, it might even drive down the cost of Delta IV.
Larry is in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and he says, have you refined your thoughts or changed any opinions regarding the likely success of the upcoming suborbital space tourism market? I really think we'll see flights start toward the end of this year or next year on commercial suborbital tourism.
Well, commercial suborbital tourism, that means Virgin Galactic, right? Is anyone else still in the business?
Yeah, Bezos is in the business with the New Shepard. So he'll be flying.
Right, and I like that. I like that concept because it's ballistic. It has no wings. It's simple. It's
automated, though. There's no pilot.
Well, that's wise. I mean...
yeah, that's wise.
Did you watch this show on the Smithsonian Channel called Air Disasters?
I've seen it. I don't know if I've seen the one you're talking about.
Well,
but I've seen it.
I'm addicted to the show, and I think I'm addicted to an airline accident website. And the one thing I learned from these websites is that airline pilots make the most appalling mistakes. And not just in third world countries either, but in advanced countries like the United States and France. So having a pilot on a spacecraft is a really bad idea, especially one that's just going to, you know, pop up and come back down again. What's the pilot going to do? What piloting can he do? That's why I like the pop-up system rather than the gliding landing thing that Virgin Galactic uses on the rare occasions they actually make a test flight, because there's too much involved with the pilot's judgment. And their big accident was caused by a clear pilot mistake caused by, you know, work overload and, you know, all that stuff in a rocket vehicle should be automated. It should all be run by a little computer. But there's no computer in Spaceship One or Spaceship Two. It's all designed with 1930s technology.
So your thoughts are in terms of this industry finally becoming commercial later this year or next year?
I think that Virgin Virgin Galactic is another disaster waiting to happen. I mean, the guys don't know what they're doing. I said, they started out with a mistake when they picked a kit plane designer to design a rocket plane, and he made a bunch of mistakes. And they never recognized those mistakes. They also, some people say the same guy was, Bert Rutan was responsible for this too, is choosing a crazy rocket system that combines all the bad features of solid fuel and liquid fuel in one package. They've just made so many mistakes, and most of their competent engineering staff have resigned in the past couple of years.
You have a caller. Do you want to take your call?
Sure.
Good afternoon, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hey, this is Kyle in Duluth.
Kyle?
Okay.
Hi, Kyle. Are you in southern Michigan where the Chinese station's going to hit you, or are you elsewhere in Michigan?
I'm in Minnesota. So
in Minnesota. Okay.
Further west.
So you're safe. Sorry about getting that mixed up. I apologize.
We should no problem. We should state here that it's impossible to predict where a piece of space junk will come down that precisely. And certainly not, 2 weeks in advance?
Yeah, but I'm just kidding around with the news articles because they're so full of BS. But that, you know, give me some credit here for having fun.
This is the one aspect of spaceflight which virtually no layman understands or can be made to understand is orbital dynamics, how orbits work and how reentries work. You know, I frequently tried to explain it to highly intelligent laymen, and a lot of people just can't understand it. So I've given up joking about it because people don't understand it's a joke.
Kyle, why are you calling? Tell us what's on your mind, please.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have to agree with you. There's a lot of variables involved. But, I had a question, but I figure I'd first just offload what I know about BFS. I was always under the impression, this is about that SSTO idea, that it would be possible but not viable economically, you know.
And what we're talking about here is taking either the first or the second stage of Big Fantasy Rocket and flying it into orbit without a payload, making a retrofire and landing back at the launch site.
Yeah. I certainly think it's possible, but it wouldn't be economically viable. And I believe it was
how are you going to earn any money? You know, it's a...
Right.
It would make an amusing stunt, and if you did it, show that, you know, Elon Technology is ahead of the rest of the world, at least back in 1990 is the last time anybody tried it. But wouldn't have anything to do with getting to Mars.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think it would, but certainly be another publicity stunt, I suppose. But my question is more to...
I think they're talking about the second stage, because only the...
That's the only one that has a heat shield on it, so it would be the only one that makes
sense. The only one that's capable of full... Yeah, it's the only one that's heat shielded and has the wings to maneuver, so it'd have to be the second stage they're talking about as an SSTO.
Yeah. But I suppose it wouldn't really be... Yeah, I don't know. But my question, I guess, deals with a comment you have made earlier on. I have to admit I hadn't listened to your earlier shows, but I am kind of curious. You had mentioned that you didn't believe that humans would ever be economical, or I would like to hear your opinions on whether or not human exploration in the future is really viable with the state of, you know, robotics these days.
Men in space is a solution looking for a problem it can solve. It was like that in 1961, when we first did it. It's even more true today when automated spacecraft are so much more capable. Right? you look back to the 50s, to the science fiction stories then, and the Von Braun propaganda image of space, and the Collier's articles, and later in the Disney specials, which Von Braun and Ernst Stuhlinger were the stars. They had lots of things for men to do in space. Then the cross section of the big inner tube space station in the Collier's article. People are doing very useful stuff in every room in the space station. In one room, guys from the Weather Bureau are tracking hurricanes on big screens. In another room, guys in sailor suits, U.S. Navy uniforms, are tracking a carrier task force on a big screen on the wall. In another room, astronomers are studying photographs of galaxies on a big screen on the wall. In a little dark room, graduate students are developing the photographic plates that have just been brought over in the little space taxi from the space telescope, which is orbiting near the space station. Right? Those were all sensible ideas in 1954 or 53, I think those articles were published. But they don't make any difference today. Von Braun and his editors were right about what we could do from outer space, but they were wrong about how we were going to do it. They didn't realize how expensive manned space travel would be, or what the extra problems would be introduced by putting a man in the loop. And they didn't understand how quickly microelectronic technology would improve. Electronic imaging, just watch a TV program from back then, if you can find one, to see how terrible electronic imaging was back then. So for people doing useful work in space, the last real gasp of that was two military spy satellite programs, MOLE, Manned Orbiting Laboratory in the U.S., which was canceled before it flew, and Almaz, which was the Soviet equivalent, which actually flew a couple missions with new military astronauts looking down through telescopes and scanning the world looking for targets. But both those programs were basically considered to be failures. And the reason is that one guy sitting up there watching the Earth go by at 17,000 miles an hour just has no way keep up to, you know, recognize, scan the ground, recognize targets, you know, point a camera, take a picture. It's just impossible. It took hundreds of people at the Satellite Imaging Center at Washington Navy Yard to scan all the pictures that were sent back by the Corona and Gambit spacecraft. And the same thing was true on the Soviet side with the Zenith. Since then, we've had some manned space station programs, but they've all basically involved, you know, scientific-type research, and nothing much has come out of them. Today, nobody would take you seriously if you proposed a manned communication satellite or a manned spy satellite or any of that stuff. So space advocates have been forced to become more and more extreme and more speculative about why they think we should spend lots of money on putting men into space. And the only thing which is really alive anymore is basically the space colonization idea. Is that Elon Musk has said straight out that he believes that Earth civilization will be destroyed by some kind of apocalypse in the near future, and that we have to establish a viable second civilization somewhere else, and the only other credible place is Mars. Most people in the space colony business seem to have that kind of extreme, apocalyptic worldview. So the reason to actually have a manned space program, and more especially a national manned space program, like NASA or Roscosmos, or even ESA has, those don't really exist anymore. The reason we had a manned space program back in 1950 and still have one today was national prestige. And some people have said that our current manned program is the national non-prestige program, since our astronauts have to train in Moscow, launch from Kazakhstan, fly and land in a Russian-built spacecraft. Supposedly that'll change in the future, but again, once we get American manned spacecraft back in action, it will only be a few years after that that the space station will go away. And everything people are proposing for, you know, manned space flight beyond ISS is pretty much a non-starter. I mean, what is the official NASA program now? Well, it's to build a smaller version of ISS somewhere near the moon that will be manned for like 40 days a year. Pardon me if I don't get excited.
No, yeah, I would see that as well. It seems to me that there are a variety of immediate, very few, only two immediate benefits to having an actual human on orbit. One would be to do microgravity research, and then the other would be to study physical effects of microgravity on life. So the first one being manufacturing, crystallization, mineral research, and the other one being life research. Those things I don't think you can't export in the same way you can satellite observation down to ground level, ground-based researchers. You'd have to have them actually on orbit in a station.
How many space stations have we had doing industrial and biological research? We had Skylab, we had Salyut, a whole series of Salyuts. We had Mir. There was no comparable American station because we were flying in circles with the shuttle. Then we had Space Station Freedom, which got made into the International Space Station when the Cold War ended. And a huge amount of money has been pumped into all those programs over the years, and I just don't see the groundbreaking research. Zero gravity industrial product has proved to be viable. Most of them have been duplicated on the ground with a little ingenuity. And the biological research is mostly aimed towards long-term human spaceflight to Mars. And people always talk about how that research is helping us cope with zero gravity health problems and radiation. But if you look at what's published, what is actually happening, at least on ISS, is that the problems get worse every time we study them. And new problems crop up all the time. Here a while back, an astronaut actually worked up the courage to tell Mission Control that his eyesight was deteriorating during the mission, which I'm sure that a lot of astronauts have observed that before on long space station missions, but since there's this natural antipathy between pilots and flight surgeons, astronauts don't like to report any health problem, which might get them, you know, crossed off the rota for future missions. But when this guy finally admitted it, and they took a scan of his head right after he landed, you know, his optic nerve looked like a snake. The weightlessness had caused his optic nerve to lengthen and squish his eyeball. This is a wholly new problem, which, you know, had never been predicted before.
What about the pharmaceutical industry?
Again, you sound like you're a lot younger than me on the phone, but this has been boosted over and over again. You know, in every space station program, there's been this hope of producing pharmaceuticals, you know, chemicals or biological products that for some reason can't be generated on the ground.
So you know, Jeff, that my family is a direct beneficiary of ISS zero microgravity pharmaceutical research that cannot be reproduced on the ground, and so are hundreds of thousands of other people that have cystic fibrosis, because it was the work of Larry DeLuca on the space station that separated out the CFTR protein in microgravity and got the genetic cause of cystic fibrosis, which has opened up phenomenal targeted genetic drugs being made here on Earth that are curing some of the CF genetic defects, not all of them, because there's a lot of them in CF. So to say that this can be done on Earth or that this is meaningless is bullshit, because I can tell you right now that CF is one of the many, many beneficiaries of microgravity research on the shuttle and the space station over the last 20-plus years.
Well, I'm not saying that there hasn't been there hasn't been useful results, but the hype is much greater than the actual production. And that thing which you've mentioned, the cystic fibrosis research, how come you never hear about it?
Well, so first of all, it's an orphan drug, and the CF community hears about it all the time. I'm constantly getting financial reports from Vertex and other companies that are using Larry's work all the time. But there's only 30,000 Americans that have CF at any given time. Ireland is the country with the biggest percentage of CF population. That doesn't mean they have the most people. It's just the biggest percentage of their population. But if you're a pulmonary medical doctor, if you're doing CRISPR research, if you're doing targeted genetic replacements and stuff like that, you hear about CF and Huntington's disease and some of the others that are prime targets for this kind of research all the time. I've been to Stanford University programs that featuring CF and Huntington's disease where there are hundreds of people there. They're mostly doctors and family members associated with these diseases talking about CRISPR and what's happening in this field. So you do hear about it. You do see articles from time to time. But, you know, if you're not focused on it, if you don't know anyone with CF, if you're not affected by it, you don't hear it in the mainstream. Would rather talk about other things.
Well, I'm asking is why the space community, the pro-space community, never cites this.
Well, first of all, Larry DeLuca's work was done a couple of decades ago, but they do cite pharmaceutical research, but it's not, they can't do it now because of the lack of a way to get the stuff back to Earth. It has to come back in a very special way, and the shuttle was able to do that. Without the shuttle, they can't do that. And it has to be researched in a very certain way on the station or on the shuttle. So opportunities disappeared for some of this type of research when the shuttles disappeared. But if you had real commercial space station with to and from reliable transportation that did not encounter really severe G-forces upon reentry, that's part of the critical requirements, which is why it was so important, then you would probably see a lot more of it. But why the space advocates don't talk about it? Look, it's known. I've talked about it at conferences. Other people have talked about it. Larry DeLuca used to talk about it in the first 5 or 8 years of the success of the thing. You know, the space cadets would rather talk about, you know, how big is the engine, the Raptor engine? How big is, you know, we're going to have SSTO with Musk? When you know exactly what this community is like. Listen, I'm a critic of all the blog posts in the space world because they're so into fantasy land and the things that could sell space and make a difference with the general public and that could really turn things around for productive use of space and commercial use of space, they're not what people grab onto. And I'm not a student of human behavior, probably even as much as you are. Maybe you're a better student of human behavior. I've always said, Jeff, that if I had my chances to do my career over again, I'd become a psychiatrist. And I would maintain my interest in space, and I would study the space advocates and the space cadets, and I would never have a boring day or a lack of information to talk about on the space show, because this is really an interesting and oftentimes really strange community. And I see some of the fantasy posted on the blogs as reality and what people focus on, and I'm thinking, you know, what planet am I really on? I mean, it's a strange world out there, Jeff. And why aren't they using real stuff to market and help develop space? Why aren't they going to Congress with real stuff that has made a difference in people's life? Why don't they take someone like my son who has CF and have him testify before Congress about what happened with his life as a result of this? But no, they don't. Anyway, I'm not going to go on a rant. We're too close to a two-hour show.
Well, you're right.
But it's sickening to me. It really pisses me off. And people have heard me say this for years. And there's so much value by developing and exploring and researching and doing things in space. And we waste so much energy, Jeff, and so much time and so much money. And we chase dragons all the time. And for someone who has seen benefits in their son's life that allows him to live and have a high quality of life as a result of something done in space, and to not see it used to help get people into space, to study STEM, to do stuff, to have viable scientific space research programs, it's heartbreaking. I don't know how else to say it.
Yeah. Well, we could also mention here the terrible way which NASA and this organization, CASAS, have managed the space station. The incredible difficulty it is to get an experiment approved to be flown up there. You've already mentioned the failure to have a replacement, smaller vehicle, more affordable vehicle to replace the space shuttle, and everybody knew it was on its last leg. Staring at me right now is a DVD I saw a while back. Actually, I think I watched it first on Amazon, called Fight for Space. And this is like a full-length movie.
I've seen it, and it's come up on my show. And what more can I just – I'll leave it. It doesn't deserve my commentary.
Yeah. Well, one of the really silly things on there is that it has two very famous science advocates, Bill Nye and Neil deGrasse Tyson. And both of them heavily promoted a big myth, which is all of modern technology, from this crappy cell phone I've been talking on to the Internet, is based on space technology. And what their little trick there is to conflate manned space programs with unmanned space programs, and also to propagate the myth that modern microelectronics was mostly developed for one or the other of those programs. And, you know, that's just not true. By the time any technology is qualified to fly in space, it's already obsolete here on the ground. That is just not true that spaceflight has ever been a major driver of electronic technology or any other technology except maybe rocket engines. And, again, a lot of that is due to the missile programs back in the 50s, which were very lavishly funded by modern terminology. Yeah. The other part of Fight for Space I like was where they went to the class of overachievers whose teacher was a space cadet and was having them do all kinds of projects about outer space. And when the teacher wasn't there, they asked the students what they thought about it. And, and they all said, yeah, none of this is actually going to happen. You know, I mean, these kids were like 11, 12 years old, and they were already jaded on outer space.
Kyle, do you have anything else? Are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm still with you. I guess the last thing is kind of slow to answer here, but just the general thought that the research costs come down with launch costs. I guess that's basic, and everyone knows that. But as these new space companies are proving, launch costs can come down, and it makes these research activities more viable than they have been in the past. So yeah. I guess, you know, but anyway, interesting discussion.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, so where is this medical research going to happen in the future after ISS is done away with?
Well,
I'm going to be doing it on this Gateway station, you know, orbiting somewhere vaguely near the moon. If crewmen are only going to be there for 40 days a year.
Give me a break.
believe that program is a major international program heavily promoted by Anatoly Zak on his Russian space website is a real program?
Do I believe it? Well, they've already modified it. It's not very popular on the space show. Listen, if we're going to go to the moon, let's go to the surface of the moon. I'm not a big supporter of the newly renamed Gateway Project, which is the Lunar Orbital Platform Dash Gateway. That's the new name.
The main change only occurred because of the new Trump space initiative in which we're going to go to the moon instead of going to Mars like the last administration was going to do.
Yeah, I know.
But this lunar station is actually nowhere near the moon, right? It's in a gigantic orbit far distant from the moon at the very top of the moon's gravity well.
It's not
the right place to start from to land on the moon.
Yeah, and they need landers to get down to the surface. And the landers aren't going to carry people. They're all planned to be robotic. So anyway, listen, you wanted to talk about, speaking about Anatoly and the Russian space program, you wanted to talk about the Russian program, the Angara, which is their new series of rockets, endless delays. There's so much corruption out there at Vostochny. It's unbelievable. What's going on with Russia from your perspective?
Well, there's a specific problem with the Russian space program, and there's the general problem of the collapse of the Russian Federation. Right now it's an economic collapse because of persistent low oil prices. It's a psychological collapse because of the endless wars in Ukraine and in Syria. It's a political collapse as the various elements of the Federation get more and more disgusted with ethnic Russian domination, and local warlords form their own private armies. The other day I read that the Minister of Defense, Sergei Shoigu, was forming his own private army out of his own particular ethnic group, the Tuvans.
Amazing.
Yeah. So a lot of people aren't really aware of this. You have to, visit, specialized interests websites. I've even set up my Google Chrome browser so it automatically translates Russian websites.
He's been sending me articles from the Jamestown Foundation. So you can pick up a couple of the articles he has sent me on the Russian space program and their weapons programs, for example, if you go to the JamestownFoundation.org website.
Yeah, let's look at a specific program, which, we could talk about embarrassing fiascos with satellite launches and gyros installed upside down and stuff like that, but those are just kind of general problems. Let's look at a specific program, Angara. All right, this was a family of boosters that was proposed many years ago, and for like decades there was no funding for it. But as opposition grew in Kazakhstan to the Russian launches there, and especially to Proton, which is a hydrazine-based booster, like the last booster still using hypergolic fuels, it's an anti-hydrazine activist organization in Kazakhstan, which is lobbying the government there to ban Proton launches completely. And there's no other launch pads for it except at Baikonur. So eventually the Angara program steadied down into two projects. Angara 1, which was supposed to replace the old Soyuz R-7 series, and Angara 5, which was supposed to replace Proton. Well, two or three years ago, they actually built some prototype vehicles, and the prototype Angara 1.2B, or some incomprehensible designation, I forget, was actually launched from Baikonur, but it was launched onto without its upper stage, which wasn't ready. and it was launched on a suborbital trajectory towards their warhead target range in Kamchatka. Not really a meaningful task. Was only not a vehicle they expect to produce. Then there was a test of Angara 5, which I already mentioned as, you know, a very well-conducted proper test of a geosynchronous launch vehicle. But nothing has happened for like, 3 years almost since then. And what's happened is that the, by just working out the regular bugs, the builder, Khrushchev Corporation, has decided to transfer production of Angara from their plant in Moscow to Omsk in Siberia. Now, as soon as I read this, I said, uh-oh. Whenever you transfer production of some big complicated aerospace thing to another plant, you know, five time zones away, you need to transfer a bunch of the original personnel along to, you know, make sure they do it right, teach them how to do it. You can't just get away with sending documents, you know. There has to be a transfer of personnel. And, of course, people in Moscow are very reluctant to go anywhere else in Russia. I mean, they look down their noses even at St. Petersburg. Being transferred to Siberia is, you know, it's like exile. Right? And they can't just order people to move. They can't just take away their apartments and, you know, order them to move nowadays in the new Russia. So I said, this is going to be a disaster. None of those people are going to move to Omsk. The plant in Omsk, the Polyat plant, had been idle for years and it, like, turned into a heap of junk like most Russian factories. So they had to spend a huge amount of money to refit it with new equipment. And now they've finally produced the second Angara 5 there. And what is it they've done with it? They've shipped it all to Moscow. They've dismantled and checked over in the old factory. And their motivation for shifting production from the giant factory in Moscow is that in order to save the company financially, they were going to close down the factory and sell the property to condo developers. Right. In Moscow and everywhere else, it seems like those are the only people with spare cash. They were going to sell off their property to condo developers to balance their books. So last I heard, the various stages of Angara 5 number 2 are, you know, in the old plant, and no bulletins have appeared anywhere, even on Anatoly Zak's site, about what's going on there. And every story I read about Omsk says that civilization really is collapsing there. All around Russia, Putin is closing down schools and hospitals to save money. He's taken back a lot of tax money from local governments. In Omsk, the government had to close down the street repair department, so there's no pothole repairs. If you want a pothole fixed, you have to fill it with potatoes yourself. And then there was another article about mass immigration from Omsk Oblast and Omsk City in particular. All the places in Russia, it's the place in which the largest fraction of its population has moved away in the last 5 years. So there's a specific high-priority program which is just, you know, just passes understanding in how incompetent it is. Then there's Putin's new weapons programs, which he touted these weapons in a big speech to his puppet parliament on March 1st. And these things got a lot of attention, but in the regular press. But then experts started to pick it apart, and they noticed that all the videos he showed had been available for like 10 years on the internet. And that all the programs, weapons programs he mentioned, either didn't exist yet or were restarts of programs that were tried and failed back in the Cold War. Let's look at a few of these. The Sarmat missile is a straight copy of the Ukrainian R-36, right? They still have 46 of these Ukrainian missiles in their silos. They carry about one-third of the rocket forces, nuclear warheads. They are no longer supported by the plant in the Ukraine, so they decided to build an all-Russian copy. And Putin showed in his talk an ejection test of this new Sarmat missile, a mass model of it being ejected from a silo. Well, it was a spectacular for a test. It was painted red and white checkerboard. It shot up out of the field of view very quickly. But then, since it was a dummy, of course, it fell back. And they didn't show that part. They cut to a simulation of the missile going into space and dispersing a whole cluster of warheads, which are then shown plunging down onto Florida. But again, people started leaking information about this test. It didn't make any sense to me when I saw it, because the old R-36 was never test launched at Plesetsk, where this test took place. It was always a Baikonur-based tested missile. And it turns out, yeah, they used a smaller silo there that was used for the old RT-23 and then for the Topol. So they used a smaller launch container, and this so-called math model of Sarmat is actually much smaller and skinnier than the actual missile will be.
Jeff, right? Yeah, we're at the two-hour point, so you need to kind of hurry it up, okay?
Yeah. If you look at all of Putin's programs, it seems that a huge amount of money is being spent on weapons programs that, you know, are either pointless or are just far too technically advanced for anybody to do them. Nuclear-powered cruise missile, we tried that in the 60s, couldn't make it work. Maneuvering reentry warheads, right? They've flown a lot of tests of this avant-garde warhead, which is capable of maneuvering during reentry. It's a lifting body, basically. Well, that was another technology that was tested extensively by us during the Cold War, and because it supposedly would make it harder for ABM to hit the missile. But it turns out that that doesn't really work. And our main ABM system, GBI, actually works out in outer space where the warheads are not able to maneuver. And this speech apparently has had a big effect on Putin's popularity. In the latest independent polls before the election next week, he's actually running neck and neck with a communist candidate.
Interesting.
Yeah. But he's already declared that he'll win 70% of the vote, so I'm sure he'll win 70% of the vote.
Or a little more. I'm sure it'll turn out that way, right?
Right.
What do you see? Anything exciting in space for the coming rest of the year? I mean, we're a quarter over with of the year, so you got three more quarters left. Anything you're looking forward to in space?
Well, I'd like to see some more launches of Falcon 27 on more realistic missions, because I'd really like to see that program succeed and provide us with an alternative to the Delta IV heavy monopoly. I'd like to see some of the liquid-fueled engine programs that are being developed here in the U.S. succeed and move more rapidly, because the idea of importing rocket engines from Russia just seems more crazy as time goes on. I'd like to see real progress on a lot of programs that don't seem to make much. Everything in space seems to move really slowly now. You know, a year can go by, and you know, programs just seem to stretch out interminably. And I guess I still remember my childhood in the 60s when everything you had twice the fun you need, and everything advance at a rapid rate.
You got one last question that came in. Excuse me, Linda's in Seattle. And she said, are you at all optimistic that we will return humans to the moon by the late 2020s?
No, not without a massive increase in NASA funding. I don't think any of the private players are really interested in landing on the moon. NASA's swerve in that direction is just because they're obeying this decree from the new National Space Council, which doesn't seem to be any better than the old National Space Council. All it's done is resulted in the renaming of this lunar orbital station, which is not anywhere near the moon. No more progress will be made in that NASA program than was made on the Mars program, which they're both basically.
Well, I hope we can bring you back and we can show you that you're wrong on that too, because I hope we do get back to the moon, although doing it in another 10 or 12 years seems kind of unconscionable to me. But
why do people want to go back to the moon? Again, this is constantly cited as an important goal, but nobody really explains why we need to spend a lot of money to do it. I mean, we went to the moon once and came back and didn't find anything much of use there. Again, these programs started out strictly as prestige propaganda programs, and a lot of people still view them that way, but, you know, I'm not sure there's enough interest in space nowadays for even a very successful program to really improve your national prestige, except maybe at home. I'd like to see better reasons for going back to the moon. One reason I think does make sense is to get ready for going to Mars, because clearly anything for a Mars trip would have to be tested out for long periods of time in space, and I think the moon might be a better place to do that than just some pre-orbiting station.
Well, yeah, a lot of us believe that the moon as a stepping stone is a good approach. So, but the NASA budget is a problem, especially with all the projects NASA is undertaking. They are not funded to do everything on their plate. There's no doubt about that.
Well, this has been true, you know, ever since the space shuttle program. There was this big boost of funding in the 60s. Already the program was being cut back by 1964. A lot of people at NASA and the general community too somehow think that we can get back to that kind of budget situation. I have a lot of right-wing friends, since I'm kind of right-wing myself, and some of them who are space cadets like to think that an election of a good, solid conservative president would immediately cause a big increase in the budget. I have liberal friends who think that liberals are better for space, and the election of an extreme liberal president would increase the budget. Well, you know, those things all happened in the past, and all that's happened is the names will get changed on the program. There's no more than minor changes in the NASA budget in terms of real dollars.
Any concluding comments, anything you want us to hold on to or to remember?
Anybody who's planning on the Russians having a space program or being able to help us out or launch our astronauts in the future had better just write that off, because that program could just vanish. Russia could conceivably vanish from the map. You know, that's what happened for the Soviet Union. It was there one day, and, you know, next day, next year, it was gone. And nobody lifted a finger to save it.
Well, maybe by the next time you come on, we'll know if that's happened or in the process of happening big time. We'll see. Jeff, keep me posted. Send me your interesting stuff, and let's talk again later in the year as more and more things accumulate and more things are around for you to give and share your opinions on.
Yeah, well, to do that, I would have to get my internet access restored.
Well, you'll...
Or switch to a different provider, which doesn't have an eight-day delay in service calls.
Well, I was going to say, you won't be back within 8 days, so you should be back up and running and just fine, but your friend...
Well, you can get a lot of work done in a week without any internet service or cable TV.
Well, and the cell phone you borrowed seems to be working just fine. So
I'm a reactionary on this. I need to get my own cell phone because the other day I was down at my primary care physician and he said, "Well, let's type us into the new database here. That old terrible database has all gone away, and so we need to re-enter everyone here. What's your cell phone number?" I don't have a cell phone number. And he says, "Well, this program requires you to have a cell phone number. I can't even enter your name unless you give me a cell phone number." So now I have doctor's orders to buy a cell phone.
The perils of Hawaii. Stay in touch with me, and I look forward to talking to you again down the road.
Yeah,
I've been... Listeners, those of you that called and emailed in, thank you very much. And I will get the program archived and we'll send it to you so that you'll have it for your memoirs and your collection. And we look forward to hearing from you down the road. You still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay. No, so I do look forward to hearing from you later in the year and down the road. So keep me posted, stay in the loop, and we will talk again, okay?
Yeah, if you're interested in this Russian stuff, well, you visit Anatoly Zak's site. He has lots of good...
Yeah, and he's on the Space Show and Hotel Mars from time to time, so he has a little bit of a different take than the Jamestown Foundation, but...
The Jamestown guys are alarmists.
To say the least, yes.
Some of their guys, in fact, a bunch of their guys, apparently are current or former CIA men, which means that they are card-carrying threat inflators, as we called them back in the Cold War. Their purpose is to view everything the Russians do or the Chinese do with alarm. And I'm a lot less alarmed than most of their columnists are because I understand more of the technology involved. And the scary thing about that is that does Putin actually believe the stuff he's told?
Well,
this is always a problem with political leaders. They're often, technically illiterate, and it's very difficult to make a presentation. And, of course, the presentations he sees are all by people who want money for their institute, right, or their plant,
right,
to keep it from collapsing completely. So I think this is why they're able to sell these unworkable ideas like the nuclear ramjet cruise missile or the maneuvering warhead that can dodge ABMs.
Yeah, I'm sure of it.
I mean, that's what happened on our side during the Cold War, and from the Russian histories I've read, there was a lot of that on the Russian side, too. I mean, their space shuttle was basically a giant threat inflation program.
Jeff, we got to log off, so I will be in touch. And listeners, Dr. Robert Zubrin is back with us tomorrow night if I get his phone number. So everybody tune in for Bob. He always has things of interest to tell us.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff, thanks again. Always good hearing from you. And keep looking up, as we like to say on the Space Show. Everybody have a great week. Keep it safe. And everybody else, keep looking up, too. Goodbye from Jeff, goodbye from David, and the Space Show.